You can't play like that.
I feel good. I feel better. I must play.
Ref, he's coming back up.
Okay. Controls the ball in this football festival and only 4 minutes remaining.
Right, lads,
four
let's
minutes.
Go.
Crucial minutes. The Germans are powerful and very strong.
Look at why!
Yeah, well, welcome to a very special Hot Spurs podcast. This week we've got an extra special guest, a little bit different this week. He hasn't played for Spurs before, but it is a football legend. It's Russell Osmond. How are you doing, Russell?
I'm fine, Steve. Thank you very much. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Now, I mean, first of all, why did you never play for Tottenham?
I don't know. I remember going Brighton to play for Tottenham. I had a Tottenham book annual going back years and years and years when I was about 7, 8 years old.
Yeah.
And I remember my parents sent it off to Spurs at the time, and it coming back with everybody having signed inside the front cover. We're talking about Alan Gilsey and Jimmy Greaves, Joe Kinnear, Phil Beale, Mike England, the whole crowd of them, you know, and it was probably my first sort of treasured footballing possession, I would think, of those days. So we go back a long way with Spurs.
Now, another little connection that we've got is, of course, we've qualified for Europa again, and Spurs fans are, you know, it's about 50-50 on whether we wanted to actually do that or not. But of course, you know, you won the UEFA Cup, as it was then back in 1981, and I'm quite sure you're someone that is an advocate of the tournament. What were your thoughts on that experience back there in 81?
It was a massive tournament in those days, and I think it's just been had some of the gloss taken off it by the increase in the size of the purse and the importance of more or less the European Cup, you know, basically the Champions League. But nevertheless, you know, to win any trophy, whether it's the League Cup, the FA Cup, Johnson's Paint Trophy, or anything, takes a lot of doing. And the UEFA Cup, the Europa Cup, or whatever you want to call it, or know it by, it's a massive trophy to win. It's a great competition. And for any player or any club that's won it, you go down in the annals of history of having achieved something quite special.
Yeah.
So it's not to be sniffed at all if you manage to compete and win such a big trophy as, you know, we did in 81 and Spurs did, I think, in the following year.
84, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's something that I think when you watch the cup final the other day, and you see the fans dancing around, and you just think, do you know what, sod it, let's just go for it, because you know what, going to Wembley or wherever the Europa Cup is next year, that's what it's all about. And for me as a Spurs fan, I think we've got to get back to that. Don't worry so much about this top four business. And let's, you know, we're in three cup competitions next year, and go for it in one of those, because, you know, the glory of winning a cup is certainly for Spurs fans what it should be and what they should, you know, strive to achieve.
Yeah, listen, every year, you know, there's hundreds and hundreds of teams go out to try and win a trophy.
Yeah.
Win the championship, stay in a division, win a trophy. Back in 1981, we were going for the treble, and we got knocked out of the FA Cup at the semi-final stage by Manchester City, who Spurs went on to beat in the cup final replay. So we lost out semi-final stage of the FA Cup. We ended up coming in as runners-up in the league to Aston Villa, and we beat Aston Villa home and away in the league that season.
Yeah.
And we knocked them out of the League Cup, I think. So we beat Aston Villa three times that season, yet they still managed to win the title, the league title that season. Our only saving grace was that we managed to go on and beat AZ Alkmaar in the UEFA Cup.
Yeah.
So, you know, in the space of about 3 weeks, we went from going, looking as a possible treble winners to double winners, to then being extremely thankful that we managed to come away with, you know, one magnificent trophy out of the three, and that was the UEFA Cup, and we're very thankful for that, because that team made history for the South Town Football Club.
That's fantastic. Who were the sort of names in that side then? That side.
Well, you start in goal with Paul Mariner. Paul Cooper. Paul Cooper in goal. We have Mickey Mills at right back. Of course, George Burley had been injured most of that season. Steve McCall played left back.
Yeah.
Myself, Terry Butcher, with the two centre halves. We had the two Dutch lads, Frans Tyson, on the right of midfield with Arnold Muren.
Oh yeah.
Johnny Walk, middle of midfield, leading goal scorer year after year after year before he went up to Liverpool and did the same there.
Yeah.
Then we had Eric Gates playing off a front two, which was Alan Brazil and Paul Mariner. You know, we were probably one of the first teams to actually play somebody just behind the two strikers that, you know, people term it as playing one off the front two or whatever, or playing a diamond shape midfield, but you know, we played diamond shape midfield with Johnny Walk, our defensive midfielder, who was leading goal scorer probably every season he played in that position.
Yeah. Well, we've got a guy at Spurs called Sandro, who people say is a defensive midfielder, but of course he's not, because he gets forward as much as he can. But our dear friend Tim Sherwood said that he doesn't like defensive midfielders. And, you know, he's got a point to a certain extent, because I don't think players should just sit there. As you say, Johnny Walk never just sat there. He got forward as much as he could as well. But, you know, if you've got the motor to get forward and back, you know, I think every team wants that. And you know, you mentioned there John Walk. I mean, he must have been fantastic to play with. And the other one you mentioned, of course, was Terry Butcher, who everyone would have heard of. I mean, why isn't he England manager? Because he must have been such a fantastic, captain there.
Well, probably because he's lived for the last 20-odd years in Scotland and managed in Scotland for the majority of that time. I think he's a born-again... he's a born-again Sassenach. he's a strange character, Terry, you know. He's a terrific character as well, but he's had a lot of managerial success when he was up there at Hearts, then Inverness and Hibs. I know he went over to Australia in between and Brentwood. So I'm not quite sure. You know, maybe he's got to do a little bit better in the Premier League or one of the big English clubs before he gets a recognition as an English manager, before he gets a job possibility of the job as an England team manager.
Yeah.
But you know, he wore his heart on his sleeve as a player, and he was a terrific player at that.
Fantastic. I've got some questions, if that's okay. We've got one here from Twaywood. At Twaywood on Twitter. He says, from 1975 to 82, Ipswich finished top three five times and lifted one FA Cup, one UEFA Cup. Is it impossible for a small club in the Premier League to ever do that again? You know, I mean, Ipswich, you know, not back then, not one of the biggest names, but they did so well. Can a team, you know, a mid-table sort of Premier League team do that again, or is it just impossible?
I think it's impossible now. Yeah. I think the disparity between what the big clubs are worth financially now to what the teams would be like in Ipswich's position.
Yeah.
You know, in the modern day, I think the gap's too big now. It's such a massive gap. You know, for teams like Ipswich was in those days to compete with, you know, your Liverpool's, Arsenal's, Chelsea's, Man City, Man United, Everton, Arsenal, you know, this day and age, it's... I think you'd only be able to get that if, in time, Ipswich managed to get back into the Premier League and managed to stay in the Premier League for a period of 10 years.
Yeah.
And then they would suddenly be able to accumulate, you know, maybe enough capital around the club, maybe the interest of a new benefactor, a new owner, somebody that would help pump even more money into the club. But as it stands at the moment, the difference financially between, you know, the big clubs and your sort of county farming community town is far too vast.
Yeah. We've got a question here from Andrew Rockall. What was Sir Bobby like day to day as a club manager? You know, obviously, again, Bobby Robson, someone that all football fans would have known about, sadly passed away a couple of years ago. One little thing about him, I know in his final sort of few days, really, there was a charity match up at Newcastle. I remember Bobby Robson being wheeled out, literally, yeah. And he met all the players, and Gazza was one of them. And the story goes that he unfortunately had to be rushed to hospital. But when the nurse or the doctor came round and said, "How are you feeling?" And he said, "How did Gazza play?" You know, I love that.
Yeah.
He just wanted to know how Gazza played. I thought
that
was well lovely.
Me. I mean, he was a footballing person.
Yeah.
He was football through and through. It was his whole life, really, and he surrounded himself with football people. Charlie Woods, who's still, you know, in Suffolk, his right-hand man. I speak to Charlie quite regularly. And I think one of Sir Bobby's great strengths was that when he compiled a team, he managed to get a team together that had got good balance, meaning they were as strong down the right-hand side of the pitch as were down the left. They were strong through the middle. They were strong attacking, and they were just as strong as a defensive unit. So the whole balance of the team was very good. And he likened it to a jigsaw puzzle.
Yeah.
Where every once in a while, and he created three or four very, very good sides at Ipswich Town Football Club, where he managed to get 11 pieces of a jigsaw more or less fit perfectly together.
Yeah.
And by doing so, it created a very, very strong unit or a strong bond as a team. And the team was the strength of the club. It wasn't about individuals. It wasn't about how good I was or how Terry Butcher was or Eric Gates, Alan Brazil, Paul Marner, Mickey Mills, Jimmy Ledbetter, Ted Phillips, if you want to go back a few years, yeah. Colin Viljon. It was about how well could you play with the person alongside you and the person in front of you. And I think that's what made Sir Bobby such a good manager.
Yeah. I mean, it seems so simple, doesn't it? And us as Spurs fans, you know, we talk every week about this player playing here and this player playing there. We've got Guy Eriksson, who seems to be always stuck out on the left, and you know we're crying out for him to play in the middle. But then again, we've got about six number tens, you know, just behind the striker at our club, and we haven't had a left back really all season. So it just seems so simple that a guy like Bobby Robson would look at it, kind of like Harry Redknapp when he came into Spurs. He just said, "Well, what Spurs need is this, that, and the other," and it seems so simple.
Well, listen, you know, when Bobby Robson was the manager, you know, Terry Butcher played left back for a while. Mick Mills was left back for a while.
Yeah.
George Burley was sort of the right back, 78 in the FA Cup.
Yeah.
You know, we had Clive Woods on the left wing. We played a whole different style of football then, but the type of football we played wasn't limited to usually staying in one position.
Yeah.
I think what, again, what Sabobi was good at was having footballers who could play the game and understood what the role was within the team. You know, I would understand Arnold Muir's position as well as Arnold understood my position.
Yeah.
Of what I was supposed to be doing for Ipswich Town Football Club in any given game of football. So if I had to suddenly fill in left side midfield, I would understand perfectly well how that job needed to be done to get us through the game. I think today, I think your modern day players are so precious with themselves.
Mm.
They're scared of playing out of position in case they don't play well, which suddenly reflects on their transfer fee value, which will then reflect on how much money they earn out of the game.
It's just a different mentality.
And we've been with Yaya Toure, who is upset because nobody's going to say happy birthday to him when he wants, you know, and you've got...
Well, we had Vertonghen, Jan Vertonghen, who's a fantastic player, and yeah. By the way, fantastic at left-back as well as centre-back, but he played with a face like a smack bum all season because he had to play at left-back. And you know, we were just praying for him to sort of put a smile on his face.
How much was he getting paid?
Well, you know, absolutely.
You know, and you can't play with a smile on your face.
And he's a brilliant left back as well, as a you know fantastic centre back. And you know where he'll play for Belgium in the World Cup at left back, and he'll play and have a smile on his face there as well. But yeah. As well as just going back to Bobby there. I mean, as well, you know, all the images of him were on that touchline, you know, big smile, you know, full of life and what have you, and with the football thing. But he could be a bit of a taskmaster as well, wasn't he? He had a bit of a streak where you know he could sort of have a go at someone as well. Is that right?
Oh yeah, he did. You know, speak his piece. I remember Alan Brazil, who went on to play at Spurs. You know, he had one or two run-ins with Sir Bobby, and that was only to be expected. You know, if you stepped out of line, you know, and quite a few of us broke curfews in those days, you know, but you'd get a bollock in.
Yeah. What year are we talking? What sort of year are we talking here, Ben? What sort of year are we talking? Sort of 78, 79, is that right?
Yeah, 78, 79 onwards. I think he had a tough time when he first came to the club. I'm not sure what year it was when he first started, but I think he had a little bit of problem with a bit of player power in the changing room. He had to overcome that. And, you know, he was from a tough background, Sir Bobby's, you know,
yeah.
Northeast mining village. So, you know, he was prepared to stand up for himself, which a lot of the players were prepared to do at the time as well. But he stood his ground as the manager and went from strength to strength.
Yeah, oh no, great. I mean, that's sometimes what people forget, you know, that we need as well. Not only someone, I mean, Spurs fans, we're terrible when it comes to managers because we want someone who's nice, someone who gets along with everyone, someone who talks to the media well, but yeah. Then someone who's also hard. You know, you don't get any harder from my stories than Bill Nick, you know, at Tottenham. You know, people say he never had a nice thing to say to anyone, yet he's, you know, he's our most, you know, coveted manager of all time. So that's just interesting. We've got a question here from the Spurs poet who says, who was his toughest Spurs opponent?
Well, I bumped into one the other day, Graham Roberts, on the golf course.
All right, yeah.
Because one or two things, we at Ipswich, we had a bit of feeling, for want of a better word, whenever we played Spurs. There was a little bit in the games, a bit of friction, and I'm not sure whether that was because, you know, some of our coaching staff from the North East weren't particularly keen on the Londoners and this, that and the other, but there was always a little bit of friction in the games, and I remember odd little scuffles here and there. We had one down at Portman Road where Mr. Bray, our centre forward, he got he somehow ended up with I think it was a broken nose and a fractured cheekbone, on the halfway line when the ball was down the other end of the pitch. And I'm not accusing Graham of doing that, but I know they had one or two tough centre-halves in those days. You know, there's Graham and Paul Miller, and Mish must have just run into the back of one of them accidentally and hurt himself.
Well, I could give them both a ring now and see if that's true or not.
Oh, they'll tell you it's true. But, you know, the difference was in those days, you gave as good as you got.
Yeah.
You know, and if you got a whack, you know, you got on with the game and you give them a whack back.
Yeah,
and
I love that.
I think there's a lot of players that I come across these days here have a lot of respect for, because you knew just how tough these boys were. You know, I played with a lad called Barry Horn at Southampton. Now, I've not seen Barry for a long time, but I stood there one day and I saw Barry get a right hook right into the mouth in the middle of a Fakai in the middle of the pitch. Knocked all his four front teeth straight out.
Yeah.
Barry just bent down, picked his teeth up off the floor, ran over to the dugout, gave the physio his teeth and just said, "Look after those, please. I'll try and get them put back in later." I went straight back into the middle of the fight that was going on the pitch. You know, no histrionics, no rolling about, no wanting the other player booked, or, you know, a stretcher to take yourself off. Yeah. He wasn't hurt, he lost his teeth, but, you know, it wasn't hurt enough to make him squeal.
Yeah. I mean, that's something I think, you know, of everything in the modern game that... you know, it's sadly, you know, we haven't got any more. You know, Mike England said that, you know, if you got a whack, you certainly didn't go down. And if you did, you got straight up because you didn't want to give the guy an inch.
Yeah, quite right.
You know, it's a shame.
You know, you expected it early on in the game.
Yeah.
It's going to give you a smack anyway.
Yeah.
You know, and if you didn't get one, you thought, well, that makes a change.
Davey Elder also asks, who's the best Spurs player you played against, if you can remember anyone that really shone out as, you know, such a talent back then? I mean, presumably Glenn Hoddle would have been around in those days, but was there anyone that sort of shone for you? You thought, oh, he's a decent player.
I played with Glenn. I played with Glenn on a few occasions for England as well.
Yeah.
And I thought Glenn was a very, very talented player, magnificent player to play with, and always difficult opponent when you played against him.
Fantastic.
And,
yeah. I'm
just trying to think of
other. I mean, we might come back to that in just a second, but because there's a few people that have mentioned Ozzy Ardiles, but we will come to that in just a second. Paul Bestall asks, does he feel that the Ipswich team under Robson is one of the most underrated in the last 40 years? I mean, some of those players that you reeled off earlier, I mean, they're household names. Fantastic side.
I don't think we're underrated. I think a lot of people remember that team. And, you know, as I travel around the country now and again, you know, and you go and have a drink in different sporting clubs and bars, and you'd be surprised the number of people that can suddenly name the Ipswich team that won the 1981 UEFA Cup, or the Ipswich team that won the 78 Cup final.
Yeah.
Not that they were Ipswich Town fans or supporters so much, but I think they liked the way Ipswich played, and because they liked the way Ipswich played, they liked watching them, and they remembered Ipswich, and had sort of always got a little bit of a soft spot for them.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't think we're underestimated. I just don't think we were as big a club as everybody else was in those days to get as many headlines as probably we should have done.
Yeah. We've just got one more question about your Ipswich days. It's from Gemma Stubbles, who her dad is a massive Ipswich fan. She says, come on, you tractor boys, first of all. And then she says, what was your greatest memory of playing under Bobby Robson? Was there anything particular he ever said to you, or a particular moment for him? Or maybe just generally...
I think the last time I played for Sir Bobby was probably the last time I played for England, which was...
Yeah.
A little bit of a funny occasion, because it was a European Championship qualifying game against Denmark, which we lost 1-0 at Wembley. But Sir Bobby told me that that was what he considered to be my best ever game for the country, which, obviously I thought I played quite well myself, so it was nice to hear from him on that count. And the only disappointing thing was that I was never picked again after that.
Oh dear.
So, you know, it's a bit of a sweet and sour moment, that one, but it was nice that I played my best game for England under his managership.
Yeah.
It's just a shame that I didn't manage to after that.
Okay, now, if it's all right, we'll just change the subject slightly, because we've got a question from Anthony Ashton, and I knew this would happen when I put the tweet out that you were coming on. He says, how did he get the Escape to Victory gig?
Through Bobby Robson. Somebody great. Got hold of Sir Bobby and made an approach to him. He then passed it down the line to the players. And bear in mind that that season we'd won the UEFA Cup, I had played every first team game that season, plus some international games. So I played 66 first team games that year. I was then given permission by Sir Bobby to go and join in making this prisoner of war film and playing a bit more football during the summer in Budapest in my holiday time, which, you know, I was single at the time, I'd got nothing planned, and getting paid for going to Budapest for another few weeks, I thought, well, that'll do me, I'll have a piece of that, and the rest of the say is history.
Yeah, that is brilliant. I mean, the great for the younger listeners, Escape to Victory is the greatest ever football movie. The first sort of hour is, in the prisoner of war camps, they're doing training sessions and that. But the final half an hour is not only the best bit of football on in a film, it's probably the best bit of football I've ever seen, because it's just so entertaining.
Quite nicely in the end.
That was great. We've obviously got a couple of other questions that I do have to ask you. Greg O'Brien says, did playing a part in Escape to Victory whet your appetite to star in any more films?
John Huston was the director of the film, you know, the great John Huston. And at the end of the film, I had a conversation with him, or to be more precise, he had a conversation with me, and he asked me if I would consider going back to Hollywood.
Yeah.
To make more films. And I thought, he's got to be having a laugh, surely. This was 1981. I was 22. I just won my first major trophy with Ipswich.
Yeah.
Still in the England national team by then. And I thought, well, no, I didn't quite fancy that. I was a novice. We made a one-off film about football, which, of course, football was involved. It was quite easy for me then. I basically turned down the offer and carried on at Ipswich. But it was nice, very nice to be asked.
Martin Pearce asked, how good was it to play with Ozzy and see him do the flick over the head in the world in the film? Were you there when he did that?
Yeah, he's hopeless, that. What's his name, Ozzy Ardiles? Absolutely hopeless. Yeah. Ozzy is a wonderful fella.
Yeah.
His wife's a lovely lady, he's a great fella, you know, my wife loves him to death, he's a character, but I look back to the World Cup when he was playing in the World Cup finals, and he was just a genius. He was a genius on the ball. You see him dancing over the ball with the ball in that fantastic sort of Argentinian kit that they used to wear, and he was like the conductor in that fantastic side that they had, and a real character. I still see him now and again, and, you know,
he's brilliant.
Ricky, and he's a one-off.
Yeah.
He's a one-off. He's a really terrific fella.
Did Sylvester Stallone give you any acting tips? I think that's a tongue-in-cheek question.
No, he didn't give us anything. No, he was good as gold.
Yeah.
I think he was as out of depth with his football and soccer terminology as we were with our acting skills. So between us, I think there's a little bit of mutual respect, and you guys stick to the football, and he stuck to the acting and turned up when he needed to, and that was it.
Yeah, he's got a great line though at half time when you're 4-1 down, and he just does it, and they just say, or it's even Michael Caine, and just says, "Come on, we can win this. We can win this." And you're like, "Come on, then, we can win this." And you don't actually go out through the tub. And sometimes I'm like 3-0 down at half time, and I think, "Come on, we can win this." Rather,
well, you know. I think it was one of my lines, you know, I don't want to go, we can win this. And Michael Caine says, "Who said that?" And
oh, it was your line. I knew that, really. I knew that, really.
I did. Yeah, it's...
Do you ever bump into Michael Caine or Sylvester Stallone and sort of say, "Oh, you know, remember we was in a film together?"
No, I'm afraid not. No, Michael Caine was lovely. He was, you know, he put everybody at ease very early on in the film. He was
fantastic.
A nice fella to deal with.
And of course, I have to ask you one final question, if it's all right. You know, the other massive star in that film was, of course, Pelé. Have you got any memories of, you know, being on set with him?
Well, I'm just looking at a picture on my kitchen wall here, where I've got a picture of myself standing in that on the pitch at the prisoner of war camp.
Yeah.
There's a picture of myself stood next to Pelé, looking quite quizzical about what's going on, and it's just signed to Russell from your friend Edson Pelé.
Wow.
You know, so it's sort of, next to that I've got one of the Skater Victory posters, and I'm just seeing Ozzy Ardiles sign that, and his name in the film was Carlos Ray.
Yeah.
Johnny Walk, obviously, he was in there, Mike Summerbee.
Yeah.
There's a team photo, Cole Prince, Casimir Dana, I said the late great Bobby Moore on the Halvard Tyson, who was a Norwegian captain.
Yeah.
So it was, that was a wonderful, wonderful experience.
Yeah. No, it's brilliant. It's, it's something that, of the hundreds and thousands of footballers that go through their careers and what have you, I think you've got that little unique thing that, you know, you also starred in this brilliant football film with Pelé and Ozzy Ardiles and Bobby Moore, you know. The three of probably, they would get in the greatest side of all time, along with Sylvester Stallone and Michael Caine as well. So,
yeah, brilliant. I'm right. I probably get a little bit blasé about it because, you know, you've done it and it's happened and it's in the past now. But, you know, when you actually stand back and, you know, you look at the little bits of memorabilia that I've got about it, and you think, crikey, you know, even though it was a heck of a long time ago now, back in 1981, you think, Jesus, that was that was something unique.
Yeah, I think every dad is looking forward to when it comes on one bank holiday Monday and saying, "Hey, watch out, my boy's 4.5 at the moment, and I just can't wait till he's about 6 and it comes on and I say, you know, go watch this. This is a great," and you'll go, "Oh, Dad, you know, that was brilliant."
Yeah.
You know, so anyway, listen, Russell, it's been fantastic chatting to you. Good luck with Ipswich, with next season and what have you. And do you reckon Spurs might possibly be able to, get a little bit better next year? What are your thoughts on that?
Depends who your new manager is and, you know, how he gets you playing.
Yeah.
You know, they have the potential to be as big as they want to be.
Yeah.
But they just have to have a little bit of patience. They have to put, you know, the right people in place and let them get on with it, you know. And I don't think it'll happen overnight, but, you know, in the next 2 or 3 years, I think they could really start to make an impression on the Premier League if the people that are running the club really want to.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not just about spending money on players, it's spending the right money on the right players.
Mm.
You've got to be very correct in your buying and, you know, your selection and your identification of players. And as I mentioned with Sir Bobby earlier, it isn't about just having one or two big names in the team. You know, your pieces of the jigsaw have to fit together. And if they can do that from top to bottom, and that means your manager, He has to be able to work with the people above him. He has to have coaching staff that can work with him, and the coaching staff have to be able to work with the players, and the players have to be able to work with each other. And if you get the balance right and you get everybody working like as well as one big jigsaw fits when it's all put together, then you've got a chance.
That's brilliant. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, we got the money, we spend the money, and then we turn up every week and, you know, we see, you know, all these multi-millionaire footballers, and we just were desperate for them to, you know, get stuck in and show us what they can do.
Yeah.
But listen, once again, thanks ever so much, Russell. Obviously, you know, you're away with my dad and a few other footballers in a few weeks, and, you know, have a great time and hope you win the old golf classic there. And, you know, I'm sure I'll see you in the summer at some point. So, listen, thanks ever so much.
Pleasure, Steve.
All right, thanks very much.
Good luck, mate.
Bye now. Thanks, bye.
Bye.
Well, that was a fantastic interview with Russell Osman. I'm buzzing from that. What a lovely, lovely guy. And just goes to show, like I've said, you know, on the show several times, that if you've got, you know, a lot of these football people, they do look at Tottenham from afar, and even though they've got no connection with Spurs, they have an affinity with them, they know what's going on there. And I just think it's so simple. Get somebody in who can, you know, get that jigsaw together and, you know, onwards and upwards. Anyway, come on, you Spurs.